Migration Conversations is a podcast that invites persons to share their migration stories. Hosted by myself, Professor Jamie Liu, each episode is an in-depth conversation with people who have experienced the Canadian immigration system or other migration regimes up close. We talk to migrants, immigrants, lawyers, policymakers, advocates, and experts. We hope that these conversations shed light on the challenges migrants face through their own voices. Welcome to Migration Conversations. In this episode, I speak with Laura Matacoro. Her name might be familiar to you because my producer, June Gleed, invited her on a previous episode as a dream guest we might have on this podcast. So delighted that she agreed to join us today. Laura is a historian and associate professor in the Department of History at Carleton University. Her research explores the history of migrants, refugees, humanitarians, and state authorities in shaping the possibilities and experiences of refuge. She is the author of Elusive Refuge, Chinese Migrants in the Cold War, published by Harvard in 2016. I want to add that she is also a fellow member of the Migration Research Collective. Welcome, Laura. I'm so excited to have you here on the podcast.
Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. And hello to your fabulous producer, June.
Yeah, June speaks glowingly of you. She was a student in your class at McGill University and had touted a lot of her knowledge and her perspective on refugees and migrants from your teaching. So it's wonderful to see the bridges and the connections, the multitude of that happening. So I wanted to start our conversation with your journey to history and academia. How did you get interested in history? Why is it so important to study?
It's a great question to start with, because I have had a very circuitous and not very straightforward journey to academia. But I think history has always been a topic of interest to me because it's, in my mind, a way that we can understand our place in the world as individuals, the way that our communities are shaped and our relationships to different communities. And it's a way of, I think, really understanding what is going on in the present, having deep context for the kinds of conversations that are unfolding in the present, the kinds of issues that people are talking about. And I would say that one of the great attractions to history is that history is a really dynamic subject. Unfortunately, it has the reputation of being somewhat stale and stagnant. But the reality is that history is always changing. The questions that we ask of the past, the sources that are available to us. So I had the great fortune of being a professional archivist before I returned and did my PhD. And so that has given me a sense of how history is created. And so I love history, and I think it's so important precisely because it is something that is always changing.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to understand that who is telling the story or what people focus on is an important aspect of being a historian. And I think, having that particular lens is important when we talk about different communities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's been so much exciting work in recent years because the people who are studying history and writing and talking about history are increasingly comfortable about talking about their own experiences and making those connections between, what's going on in the present and past events. And so having multiple voices, multiple perspective, it's also critical and it's also enriching. We really just benefit so much from having different perspectives, around the table.
Yeah, and you and I are both scholars who study issues related to migration and refugees. Much of your work foregrounds histories of race and exclusion, and in some ways maybe considered, as you said, marginal by some. Why is it important to look at these stories in particular when thinking about migration and refugees?
I think it's important for a couple of reasons. If I were to think about it in the Canadian context, the first thing that comes to mind is, our capacity as Canadians to tell really grand narratives about our country's past, about our capacity to offer refuge. And I think those narratives are important, and they certainly have some, you know, historical truth to them. But the reality is that such narratives are much, much more complicated. And I really don't think that we can understand, you know, histories of white settler societies, of the politics of asylum in the present, if we don't talk about how immigration regimes historically and in the present are designed to exclude, right? And so we need to talk about histories of who has been welcomed, who has been rejected. So I think it's really important to talk about histories of race and exclusion, because they are not peripheral stories. They're actually core to how countries like the United States and Canada, other white settler societies like Australia and New Zealand, how they have structured entire nation building projects. And so I definitely get the idea that, you know, talking about histories of migration or refugees might appear marginal in some respects, but to me, they're actually core to how nations develop. They're also core to how historical actors experience the world. And to me, that's also something that's really important, that we shouldn't just write or tell histories that speak to power in terms of what states might want to represent or institutions, but to really think about the lived experience of historical subjects and understand what was important to them, how they saw the world, how they moved through the world. And that, I think, is the core, you know, the core enterprise if we're talking about histories of migration, refugeehood, you know, looking at individual experiences. And this is very much a social history approach, but I think looking at how people experience the world lets us challenge and lets us interrogate really grand narratives, especially when it comes to questions of asylum and refuge, you know, narratives that talk about places as welcoming. Well, to what extent is that true if we go back and look at the experiences of diverse groups throughout history?
That's a really excellent point. And I think this is a perfect segue into your amazing work in your book, Elusive Refuge, Chinese Migrants in the Cold War. The focus of your book focuses on a time before the Indo-Chinese resettlement in Canada, which has received a lot of attention, and a lot of people are quite aware of this movement of people. Can you speak about why there was a flow of Chinese refugees during the Cold War period? Why was this occurring?
Yeah, I can speak to that in a couple of ways, because I think it also lets me talk about a history that has been forgotten. You know, when I was just talking about these narratives, we know a lot about the resettlement of Indo-Chinese refugees. It's something that Canadians and Americans talk about. But that narrative also disguises, you know, a very complex history around the Vietnam War and Canadian complicity with the American War in Vietnam, as the conflict is known in Vietnam. And so, as context, there was considerable movement of refugees in Asia prior, even prior to the Cold War, right? When we look at what happened in the context of the Second World War, massive displacement in China as a result of conflict within China, but also massive displacement as the Japanese Empire extended and then retracted. And so we tend to, I think, when we talk about histories of displacement, think about them as quite exceptional. But in reality, the history of the human world is a history of mobility, with various degrees of forced or free movement. And so there's a long history of displacement and movement in Asia. And the reason that I started looking at this early history in the context of the Cold War was because I had never heard of it. So I proposed to do a PhD on refugees in Canada when I went to UBC. And my idea was to focus on the Indo-Chinese refugees in particular and contrast the experience of Indo-Chinese refugees with that of European refugees who had moved previously. So refugees from the Hungarian Revolution and also the repression of the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia in 1968. And so my focus was on refugee stories that I had already heard about. And I happened to be reading a textbook. I mean, talk about fortune and fate, I read a textbook by Nanette Kelly and Michael Treblecock, which you probably know, The Making of the Mosaic. And there's a single sentence in that book which references the resettlement of 100 families to Canada from Hong Kong in 1962. And, you know, the sparks immediately started to fly in terms of my brain cells. And I was asking questions like, who are these families? Where are they coming from? Why have I not heard of this? And, you know, 1962 is interesting in terms of Canadian immigration history, because it's also where we start to see a change in what had previously been racially explicit regulations. And so there's an opening up. We start to see the introduction of different, more neutral criteria in terms of immigration selection in the same year that we have these 100 families coming from Hong Kong. So to circle back and answer your question, there's all kinds of displacement in Asia prior to the period that the book focuses on, which is the Cold War. But essentially, with the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949, all kinds of people leave, both as it becomes clear that the communists are going to take power, and then once the People's Republic of China is formally established. And we're talking about millions of people. And it's really a fascinating history, because there's long, long movement out of China, and particularly into Hong Kong, which is where Elusive Refuge focuses, because in 1949, Hong Kong is still a British colony. It's very much connected to the histories of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, and the United States as a result of that. And so I was trying to tease out a history that would connect the movement of people with many different parts of the world. I was trying to see this as a very large-scale story. And so because there's a long history of mobility between mainland China and Hong Kong, there's a whole debate that emerges around whether or not the people leaving China and going to Hong Kong, and in some ways getting stuck, because it's very difficult for people to leave Hong Kong because of all these exclusionary immigration laws in other parts of the world. So the question is, are these people refugees? And does the international community have any responsibility towards these people? So that's a debate that's happening at one level. On the other level is the lived experience of people who are leaving mainland China and don't necessarily consider themselves refugees, might be moving to Hong Kong because they have family there, or, you know, people from their village that they know. And they might be thinking of going to Hong Kong very temporarily, and then ultimately they'll go back to China once things settle down. Like, it's a very, very fluid moment in terms of thinking about how people are moving, and not necessarily moving as a particular category of people. And I think that was one of the things that really interested me with this particular topic, was trying to understand how, you know, a long history of Chinese migration and a very established Chinese diaspora globally, how that connected with this focus in the post-Second World War period on the question of refugees. Who is a refugee? How should refugeehood be defined? And then what responsibilities do people have towards people that UN, for instance, was defining as refugees?
That is so interesting, because I have to admit that prior to reading your book, I had no idea about this particular movement. And it's kind of ironic, because some of my relatives were part of that movement to Hong Kong. And a couple of years ago, when I was doing field research, I went and looked for a village where there was Liu's. It was a Liu village in, you know, outskirts of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And it was created because of this very movement that you talked about, when, you know, the communist government was forming and people were fleeing. And I still have relatives to this day in Hong Kong because of that movement. So it's really interesting to see this, and how I never thought about how there isn't a lot of historical writing on this piece and Canada's connection to it. And, you know, especially reading your book, I had never heard the term rice refugees before. And I wanted to kind of build upon what you were just saying about how, you know, the language matters and how people are defined or identified matters. Can you explain how and why Chinese refugees were called that? Why language matters? How is the refugee label imposed, embraced, negotiated by people? And how does it inform identities of groups of people?
Yeah, those are amazing questions. I'm cognizant that we don't have many, many days, because I could talk about this for many, many days. But the, you know, when I was talking about the movement of people back and forth between China and Hong Kong, and obviously a lot of refugees also went to, or a lot of people also went to Taiwan. You see, I'm watching my language there as well, right? I'm like, do I use the term refugees? Do I use the term people or migrants? But there was, there was concern about just the size. We're talking about 2 million people over the course of the period between 1949 and 1951, when China actually closes the border. It's a lot of movement. And so for colonial authorities in Hong Kong, you know, the British were saying, we're not going to actively encourage people to come. Hong Kong was devastated by the Japanese occupation during the Second World War. So you have a situation where thousands and thousands of people are coming and the infrastructure is not there to support them. And so there really was a desire on the part of colonial authorities to discourage people from coming. And so they really minimize any sense of obligation that they might have had to provide, you know, shelter and food and things like this. And there's some devastating fires in the settlements that ultimately, you know, encourage the government to do more. But part of their strategy around discouraging movement was, one, so they're not going to provide, you know, a great deal of service and infrastructure. That becomes the work of missionaries and community organizations in Hong Kong who also have left China, right? The missionaries are being expelled. And so they resettle in Hong Kong in the hopes that they'll eventually be able to go back to China. But in the meantime, they're providing support to refugees. So the colonial government is saying, you know, we don't want people to come. We're not going to provide a lot of support. Other people take up that work. The other thing that the colonial government does is try and minimize any sense of sort of rhetorical responsibility. So calling people refugees is a problem, because increasingly in the post-Second World War period, when you talk about refugees, particularly in the European context, there's this idea that you need to do something to help them. And so the term rice refugees gets used in a couple of different instances. It's used by some American diplomats and by some British colonial officials. And it borrows from an early term that had been used in China by Western missionaries who didn't believe that people were converting for true reasons. You can't see me, I just did air quotes there. And so what they would refer to people as rice Christians, with the idea that they were converting only so that they could obtain, you know, the resources that missionaries had available, whether that was food or other kinds of support. And so the term is highly, highly derogatory. It totally undermines any sense of authenticity or integrity in terms of whether people were real Christians or real refugees. And to me, you know, when I came across that term, it was really striking, because of course, over the time that I was writing Elusive Refuge, there were all kinds of conversations happening in Canada and the US and Europe around, you know, true refugees, queue jumpers. Shauna Labman has done some great work on this, right? Talking about the different streams of refugees and the way that language gets, like, labels get imposed to really undermine any sense of responsibility. And I think one of the things that I continue to be struck by, I'm just going to ramble for a sec, is that the sense of responsibility historically vis-a-vis refugees is one that has been constructed and that is fragile. And there's no guarantee that people will respond with a sense of obligation or duty or charity towards people such as refugees who they perceive to be in need. And so for, in my mind, any sort of discussion of a history of refugees is also entwined with a history of responsibility or a sense of responsibility. And so language is really important in that respect, because it means that, you know, in order to foster a certain sense of responsibility, advocates have used language. They've also used images that are meant to convey need. But that language and those images can be really troubling, because they tend to present people as just passive victims who aren't making decisions about their lives, you know, based on their own circumstances and their families and their communities. And that's really troubling in many respects. And so, you know, when we think about language, it's not just the language that governments use, but we also, I think, have to be really aware of how we speak about people, even when we meet, when we have the best of intentions. And so one of the things that was fascinating in researching Elusive Refuge, and I did a number of interviews with people who had either left China after 1949 or whose families had left. And there was discomfort around the term refugee because they didn't necessarily think of themselves that way. And they also didn't necessarily like the association, right? That they were somehow in need or you know, at the mercy of other people's charity. And that was a really eye-opening insight that I gleaned from doing these interviews, that the term refugee itself can be something that people, you know, think about and decide whether or not they want to employ. You know, if you're legally defined as a refugee, I think it's different, but there's a whole bunch of gray areas. And certainly in the period that I was looking at, the term refugee is, you know, slowly becoming defined in international law and domestic law. So there's a lot of negotiation around that. And it wasn't an obvious one in many, many ways.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You know, we will talk about this later, but also just to think about how in present day, how we interact with people who come to Canada with refugee protection or refugee status, and how, you know, certainly in my own experience, some of these people do not want to be associated with that term or don't want to identify with, or they talk about it in the past that I was a refugee, you know, and I think there's something to be said about that and, you know, how people communicate the work that they're doing in the refugee field and or assisting refugees, and how that can be and not the same kind of narrative that the people, you know, being implicated by it, how their feelings might be quite different than what is being perceived, right? It's very, yeah. That's a very interesting aspect of your work. Along the lines of what you were saying earlier, that you were contrasting different, you know, movements of people, you write that there was an indifference or disregard of Chinese refugees by the international community, and that this was in stark contrast to European migrants at the same time. In your view, why was this the case? You know, what was happening that made it such a stark difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because the book came out 5 years ago now, which is sort of incredible. And of course, in that time, I have revisited the topic in many different ways. And I think I would almost evolve that argument if I were writing the book again today to suggest that not only was there was a certain degree of indifference in terms of there was a capacity to sort of write the situation in Hong Kong and China, you know, out of the realm of what states wanted to be responsible for. And so I do think there's an indifference there. But it's really interesting going back to look at, you know, the deliberations around the drafting of the 1951 convention. We see references to refugees in China, to refugees from partition. And there's a deliberate decision and a deliberate effort to write out any sense of responsibility for these refugees outside of Europe, because the fear was that there would be too much, that if the convention, the definition of refugeehood in the convention itself was written in a way that was, you know, very encompassing and universalizing, that there would be too much demand on the potential receiving states. And so there is an indifference, but it's also, you know, as I rethink that moment, I see it more and more as a very active exclusion. It's not that people didn't care. They actually cared very much, but in a way that meant that they didn't want to deal with right. I mean, this is still a period where racist immigration laws are explicit in countries like Canada and the United States. And so, you know, the kind of what's the best way of describing it? I'm talking with my hands, but it's kind of this awkward dance, right? To when you see that there are refugees, but you know that you don't necessarily want to include them within the scope of responsibility. And one of the things that I'm working on now, because I'm still trying to understand, you know, there's a great debate about the extent to which the 1951 convention is a Eurocentric piece of law. And when I wrote Elusive Refuge, my understanding, you know, if you look at the definition of individual persecution, in my mind, that is the most explicit example of how Eurocentric the convention is, because the geographic limitation that signatories had to make a decision about is actually much more complicated. When I first started looking at it, I assumed that all the signatories had chosen the more restrictive option, so events occurring in Europe before 1951. And in fact, it's a real mix. Some people are choosing the more restrictive option, in particular France, and applying that to all of its colonial holdings, which obviously changes very quickly after the convention comes into play. But a lot of countries are choosing the more geographically expansive option. So events occurring in Europe before, or occurring before 1951 in Europe and beyond. So the phrase, the language there is interesting, right? Europe is still the focus, but there is this beyond. And so to me, the relationship between the convention, which is being drafted at the same time that millions of people are moving into Hong Kong and millions of people are moving throughout Southeast Asia and Asia and other parts of the world. There is, you know, I keep coming back to that idea of indifference. I think I'd actually write it differently, because I think actually a lot of work went into framing a definition and a geographic application that made it possible for people to then, you know, then ignore large refugee movements. So it's a great question, because it lets me demonstrate how history is a changing.
It's evolving.
It's evolving, right? And historians such as myself, I think we feel quite comfortable based on the evidence that we have making some conclusions, and then events change and we have more evidence and we ask different questions and we start to think about, well, maybe there's a better way of understanding or explaining what was going on. So
definitely. And I think, you know, this is very apt, you know, that whenever we talk about the ways in which immigration law, for example, excludes, it is an active act, I would say, right? There's deliberation, there's parsing of the words. I mean, so it is, I think, a very apt way to describe perhaps different approaches and policies in relation to refugees. So this, you know, also brings to mind, you know, this act of exclusion also in the experience of Chinese refugees, illustrates this kind of settler colonial mentality, which you've referred to a number of times in our talk already, where people are excluded based on race, right? That settler colonialism relies on the settlement of select individuals for the express purpose of securing control over people and territory. And I wondered if you could talk more about that, explain what this race thinking is and how it was and remains informative in our immigration policies.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about settler colonialism, it's complicated in a couple of ways by the history of migration, particularly racialized migrants and also refugees. And I say that because the initial sort of scholarship on settler societies and the making of settler societies was very much focused on questions of whiteness, right? How did white supremacy dictate and shape how certain people were seen as desirable and others were not? And race thinking, this is a term that I really have learned a lot about, but I initially encountered it reading Hannah Arendt, you know, how race informs how we see the world. And the race thinking and white supremacy meant that, you know, there's a real hierarchy in terms of who's seen as desirable. And we, you know, critical race scholars will point to race as a factor, but they'll also point to economics, you know, class and gender. And so all of these are bound up with these ideas about who is a desirable citizen, because white settler societies have historically been very happy to exploit racialized labor on a temporary basis. But when it comes to citizenship, this is the making of the nation. And so for the work that I do, where I'm looking at the movement of migrants and refugees who were not desired by white settler societies, and yet who came anyway and ultimately stayed, you know, put down roots, maintained ties abroad, and often had very diasporic existences. It's an important issue because it raises a question of where do racialized settlers sit in these histories of white settler societies, which were never white. That's one thing that we should make very clear, both in terms of indigenous peoples, but also the settlers who did come. And I'm still working through, I think this is a really important issue that we need to do a lot more sort of research on, particularly thinking about relationships between communities. But I do think that, you know, when it comes to racialized migrants and refugees, there's important questions about complicity important questions about complicity. I also think where it gets complicated, and I'll just use the Canadian context as example, and I've sort of alluded to this previously, but the Canadian government, and I would say Canadian citizens broadly, have this idea of Canada as a humanitarian nation. And it's something that we, you know, that is included in the citizenship guide. It's very much part of the public discourse and the making of the Canadian national identity. And I was really struck when I started looking at this sort of narrative that it emerges, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, when Canada is confronting a history of, you know, racist immigration laws, and it's also encountering considerable protest and resistance on the part of First Nations. It's confronting separatist and independence movements in Quebec. And so the narrative is not an innocent narrative. It actually gets redeployed in all kinds of different contexts. And so I think this is where the other aspect of the relationship between histories of refugee movements and settler colonialism become really complicated, because I have argued in probably too many places now that the narrative of being a humanitarian nation or being a humanitarian society disguises histories of settler colonialism, disguises displacement of Indigenous peoples, both in the past but ongoing, disguises ongoing violence. And so, you know, it's a narrative that works on some levels, and is, you know, as I say, there is a grain of truth, there is historical truth to this idea that Canada has been a humanitarian nation in some respects. But I think that increasingly, when I hear narratives like that, or sort of broad claims to greatness and niceness, my immediate reaction now is to say, well, what is that hiding? What does that not tell us? And so, I think as you can tell from my rambling answer, I think the history of refugee movements and the history of settler colonialism is incredibly complex. And I think if I could just say one more thing on this point, I think it's complex as well, because when you look at how, for instance, refugees hear the stories of First Nations in Canada, hear stories of residential schools, forced language loss, forced displacement, there is a capacity to empathize and understand those experiences in ways that people who haven't experienced displacement and similar losses, they don't have that. And so it is an incredibly complex issue. And I think it looks different, to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, it looks very different depending on what perspective you're adopting.
Thank you. That was an amazing unpacking in just a very short period of time. So amazing job. I want to riff off something you were talking about. You know, you talk about the humanitarian narrative, but I think ultimately you write about this in your book that immigration policies have long been understood as prerogative, right, of individual nations, and that in reality, they're the result of shared communications outlooks that normalize the acceptance of some migrants and not others. And knowing this and how important it is for nation states to lobby in a humanitarian sense, and looking at the history of the humanitarian lobbying that took place for Chinese refugees at that time, comparing that to contemporary cases, like what, you know, what does that tell us about, you know, what you were saying as propping up a particular narrative, or how do these things, how can they be deployed or not deployed, or what harm can they do as well?
Oh, it's such a great question. Clearly, I just say that to every question you ask. They're all great. Yeah, so the reference to sort of relying on other nations, it's inspired by a lot of work that's been done on the original exclusion laws in Canada and the US, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. Now, Charles Price has a book called Great White Walls Are Built. And it's about how these various countries look to one another. You know, we see dictation tests and literacy tests. These are all technologies that countries borrow from one another and really feed the argument that you know, whiteness is actually a really fragile enterprise and it takes a lot of work. And so states relied on one another. If something worked in one jurisdiction or was passed in one jurisdiction, then, and you know, another jurisdiction thought, well, we'll give that a try. And so to me, it has relevance, you know, both in terms of the contemporary moment and the kinds of negotiations. I mean, we can talk about the third safe country agreement, right? As a prime, like a very obvious example of nations coordinating because they have a shared purpose in mind. But it, to me, it also speaks to the role of transnational diasporic civil society actors. You know, when I was looking at the kind of advocacy that took place around Chinese refugees and the resettlement, to go back to the story of the 100 families who came in 1962, part of that advocacy work had been taking place both in Hong Kong and in Canada because missionaries, unlike British colonial authorities, missionaries were writing home and saying, this is really bad. The situation here is really bad. People don't have proper shelter. They don't have enough food to eat. They're caught in between because they're not recognized as refugees. And so there was advocacy, for instance, happening in Canada with Anglican missionaries writing home to their home congregations and saying, you need to do something. And so then there were congregations in Canada that were appealing to the federal government. And ultimately, it really was a compromise to have 100 families come because it made it look like the Canadian government was doing something, but not doing too much. It was kind of a safe kind of decision, but that took a lot of work. And so I'm always struck by, I think, the contrast or the relationship between states and their capacity to coordinate, you know, essentially to coordinate very narrow asylum procedures and asylum regimes, and then the capacity of civil society to also coordinate and make refuge possible. And David Fitzgerald has this fascinating book that just came out, and the title escapes me, but he, you know, his argument is all that the future of refugee determination processes and asylum regimes, it rests with civil society. And that's a really optimistic argument because it's a lot of work. And increasingly governments are doing things out of sight, out of mind, right? And so the capacity to intervene, I think, is one that is becoming increasingly challenged. And I'm not a historian who likes to make predictions about the present or the future, but I am really interested in that, you know, the capacity of states to do all kinds of things remotely. And I wonder about civil society's capacity to respond.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the work of our fellow friend and colleague, Shauna Lebman, and how she talks about there is, you know, an increase towards the privatization of resettlement of refugees and the capacity of civil society or other entities other than government to fill in those gaps that in the past government was seen as the primary actor in doing. So I think it's a really interesting question that this raises. But, you know, I know you don't like to make predictions as a historian, but I might invite you anyways to talk about how, you know, we are living in a time where there are multiple ongoing refugee and humanitarian crises around the world. What lessons can we take from looking at the Chinese refugee story that you spent a lot of time with? What kinds of things can we learn from or that we should take as cautionary tales?
Not only is that a great question, it's a really, really, really difficult question. because I think my answers have changed over time. I think that had you asked me this question, for instance, before the pandemic, I might have said something about, you know, advocating for people as full human beings and not because they're refugees, right? Not essentializing their experiences. And I still think that is really, really important. But I have to say that over the past year, seeing the ways in which, you know, refugee communities have been caught in some, on some respects, you know, having fled their homes and then maybe being in camps and then really not having anywhere to go because of international restrictions. I think that the needs and the maybe the vulnerability have become that much more great. And so I'm not sure that I would, I still think that we need to talk about people as complicated and compelling human beings who have rich, rich experiences. And I think my concern, you know, when I was doing the research around Elusive Refuge is that the advocacy on behalf of refugees often takes the shape, and I understand why it does, you know, in practical terms, but it takes the shape of these will be contributing citizens. And I always feel like that's such a tremendous burden and imposition of expectations because people have all kinds of different capacities and all kinds of different life experiences. And this is where the academic is not at all useful as a policymaker. But I just think that if we put the onus on, you know, contributing members of society, we fail to celebrate how just wonderful and rich people's lives are and how much people, you know, go through in making a decision to leave their home and entrusting that they will find refuge somewhere, whether it be with families or neighbors or. And so I think, you know, it's maybe really cliche, but I ultimately come back to this question of how as a historian can I humanize past experiences so migration is not just numbers and policies. And I think in the present, you know, how can we have a conversation where people are allowed to be fully human with all of our flaws and foibles? And it's hard to do, right? I think it's become increasingly challenging for a number of reasons, but it is my hope when we talk about questions of migration and refugees that we can, do so with a more of an open spirit than we've been doing. But I understand how hard that is given the kind of backlash, the anti-immigrant sentiment, the racism that we've seen over the past year. It's really, really troubling. And so I don't have a great answer because, as I say, I think this past year has been really, really disruptive. Obviously, but also in terms of how I understand the world and maybe the relationship of the present to the past. We talk about historical continuities and change, and I think this is a moment of disruption. And so it's making me even less inclined to make predictions about the future, but I think it opens up possibilities. And I hope that the possibilities that ultimately flourish are ones where we are a kinder world.
Well, if I can say, your work has made me think quite a bit about how the things and the rationales in our immigration system are not happenstance, they're not innovative or new. I mean, you spoke earlier about the coordination and the copying and riffing off of other nations' practices and systems. And I mean, the whole Five Eyes system between the five states and how there's security measures and information sharing, this is all, you know, as a result of this ongoing project that has started way in the past, as you've noted. So it's not innovative or new, but it is a different replication of the same kinds of ideas and practices. I'm also cognizant that I realized throughout this whole episode, I've been referring to people as Chinese refugees. And I'm not sure why I kept saying that, even though we had a huge conversation about the importance of language and terms, but it really does also make me think about how it's really difficult to come up with the proper language and what kind of meaning we attribute to it and thinking more through. And I think maybe because I was just so fixated on the fact that there's probably so many communities of people that have different kinds of suffering that we have yet to learn about or yet to become aware about and yet to study or learn from. And that I think your book is a testament to that there's so many things that get a lot of attention, traction, and support from the coordination of humanitarian movements among states, but that there's quite a few pockets of communities that might not garner the same kind of attention or may not be talked about in ways that are respectful to that community's identity. So I think, you know, if anything else, I think that your work has done some amazing, pulled some amazing threads as to allow us to say that these things are not accidental, they're not happenstance, they're not innovative. There, you know, these things have happened before, and to also kind of keep our eyes and ears open about what is it that the state's asking us to look at, to focus on, to pay attention to throw our humanitarian support behind when there could be other things that we might want to also consider. So that's just a few thoughts that I had while we were discussing this, but you're, yes, go ahead.
So, yeah, I'm doing my air finger there. I do, just to pick up on that very quickly, I mean, I think the reference to Chinese refugees is important because it matters where people come from. Places have histories and people from those places have histories. And so there is no way that we can understand the resistance to addressing the refugee situation in China and Hong Kong without thinking about the beginning of Chinese exclusion in the 19th century, that long history of diasporic migration. It sets, you know, there are certain historical factors in play when all of a sudden there are millions of people moving. It means that the people moving have relationships, you know, near and far in terms of families in Canada and elsewhere. But it also means that states have this history of resisting, you know, and outright excluding Chinese migrants. And so to understand the history of exclusion around a particular group of refugees, we also have to think about the wider histories of migration involving, you know, particular communities, but also other forms of migration. And so, you know, the same way that historians will write about the resettlement of Syrian refugees, for instance, you know, I don't think that they will be able to do that without talking about histories of colonialism, of, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment. I mean, to understand the significance of what happened, we need to think about these larger histories. And so, you know, maybe one way of using language in a really productive and useful way is to be more explicit rather than sort of the universalizing refugees, you know, all the same. Think about, well, what about women? What about children? What about different parts of the world, right? I think there are all kinds of ways that we can take a category that has been in many ways, you know, an attempt to in past decades, the effort has been to kind of create this universal definition or criteria for refugees. And I think, you know, so many scholars and historians have spent a lot of time, A, thinking about how that definition came to be, but also looking at the other definitions, the ways that people have refused that definition, and really thinking about experiences not based on some kind of categorical definition, but rather what has been happening on the ground. So There are ways of using language in.
It's true, and I think one of the things that is very alive in your work is that, you know, the narrative is always talking about the permissive, how we've let so many people in, how we're a nation of migrants, and yet there's so much work to be done. There's so much work being done about excluding people and the various ways in which people are excluded. So this is like, you know. The way that you've discussed this provides a counter narrative or a process by which we interrogate the permissive aspects of, or the, you know, perceived permissive aspects of the immigration system. I want to pivot slightly. You do a lot of amazing work, and with the leftover time that we have, I want to talk about your work on sanctuary, particularly on sanctuary for migrants. And I wanted to ask, can you explain what sanctuary is in the context of migration, and how did sanctuary practices form?
So sanctuary is a term that generally refers, so there are a couple of ways of sanctuary, of defining sanctuary, but it essentially is the offer of refuge or protection in a sacred space. And it's very much bound up Western Christian traditions, particularly in medieval Europe. A lot of the inherited traditions around sanctuary come from that period where there were laws that governed who could be in sanctuary, for how long, under what terms. And sanctuary is fascinating. It's a much longer history than back to medieval Europe. We see it in ancient Rome and Greece, and there are all kinds of references in the Bible to cities of refuge. But in these earlier periods, sanctuary was often for criminals, for people people who had done a crime.
Who had committed a crime,
thank you. And the idea was that in order to sort of mitigate the more extremes of the criminal justice system, and sort of the idea of blood vengeance, is people would have time in sanctuary and everyone could sort of sort out a better solution. And so that is the early tradition of sanctuary. And it has changed radically in recent years, late 20th century, early 21st century, where we're talking about sanctuary as a form of protection for migrants facing deportation. There's some work on the idea of sanctuary and the Underground Railroad for fugitive slaves who are leaving the United States or Southern United States and making their way north and sometimes into Canada. So that's one of the ways that we see sanctuary in a more modern context, because they were certainly assisted by religious workers and were sheltered in all kinds of places. But the current use of sanctuary is both in terms of that idea of protection in a sacred space, and customary law means that it's very, very rare for state authorities to go into a church. And so the idea is you protect a migrant who's facing deportation and you try and come up with a solution so that they're not deported back to dangerous conditions. And it's often a sign that something hasn't worked with the immigration or the refugee determination system. And so congregations will make a decision to offer sanctuary with really a lot of reflection. It's very tricky for the people in sanctuary. They can't leave the church. And so there's a feeling of being trapped or almost a carceral experience. And then for congregations that are offering support, there's a whole bunch of unease about the legality or lack of legality about what they're doing. And so these are decisions that are made very, very carefully and with a lot of deliberation. And it was it became very pronounced in the 1980s because of the conflicts in Central America. And so what was called it became described as a sanctuary movement, but essentially because there were refugees who were making their way to the United States and being refused, partly because the American government was funding the very conflicts that they were fleeing, churches across the country took it upon themselves to protect refugees from deportation. They actively, brought them into sanctuary. And it really was a widespread movement that was about, opposing American foreign policy, providing support to people who were not getting support from the existing refugee determination processes. And there was a similar movement here in Canada to support Central American refugees. And so it became quite a pronounced movement in the 1980s, and it's been repurposed in recent years in what people are calling the new sanctuary movement. And we see it less. We definitely still see churches offering protection, but it's actually become much more broad-based. And I argue it's a slightly different genealogy, where sanctuary cities, so Montreal briefly was a sanctuary city. Ottawa has flirted with the idea. There are a number of cities in Canada who have either declared themselves sanctuaries or thought about it. But the idea is that in a city, municipal authorities can offer services without asking about people's immigration status. People can be, stopped for minor traffic violations and not have their immigration status revealed to federal immigration enforcement officials and face deportation. So it's an idea. The idea is that the federal system is not working as it should, especially in the United States, but also in Canada. And so municipalities have taken upon themselves to declare themselves safe spaces. And so you can see that sanctuary as a concept and as a practice has really evolved quite a bit over the centuries. And the current discussion is very much around undocumented migrants or refugees facing deportation.
Yeah, I really like how you talk about it as kind of a symptom, right? That the sanctuaries are responding to the gaps or the issues and the problems in our immigration system. And people feel that their immigration system is not acting fairly or properly, or there's something awry going on whereby they feel compelled to step in somehow, right? And engage in providing a different kind of temporary protection until something can be resolved. So that's a really interesting concept, and it kind of is a very hopeful concept in terms of how communities are formed, communities support mutual aid. It's very inspiring. And I wanted to maybe, you know, round out this discussion by asking, so, you know, sanctuaries are, you know, and the way you've studied it are exploring histories of place and notions of responsibility. And I wondered if you could talk more about that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been working on sanctuary for so long, and it's partly because it grew out of my work on the history of Chinese refugees, where I was so interested in both how people were making decisions for themselves about where they were going to go and, you know, how they were going to make their way to different places, but also the role of civil society in advocating. You know, I talked about it earlier in terms of the missionaries and the transnational activism between Hong Kong and Canada. And so it was the civil society activism that really, really captured my imagination, and trying to understand what role civil society actors have played, sometimes in cooperation with, but sometimes in resistance to governmental authorities. And so that really was the spark for this sanctuary research. And the other thing that I was really wanting to understand is just, how is it that certain communities have the sense of responsibility, but also the sense that they have the authority to offer refuge or offer sanctuary? So I was aware of the privilege that, you know, Christian churches enjoyed in that regard. And there have been cases of people seeking, for example, refuge in Sikh temples, and a whole discussion about whether or not the federal government would respect a Sikh temple as a religious space that shouldn't be violated, right? And so that became a really important part of the thinking and the ongoing work that I'm doing on sanctuary is also to understand, you know, the motive for offering sanctuary, for going into sanctuary, but also what kinds of sanctuary have, you know, what forms of sanctuary have been considered legitimate. And to go back to this question of, you know, settler colonialism and migration and refugees, there are a number of instances where First Nation communities have offered refuge either on reserve or by adopting people into community. And it has been contested by the federal government. And to me, that just speaks so much to the core of the settler colonial project, where certain communities are, you know, the sovereignty and the customary practices of certain communities are respected and others not. And I think that the whole question, I mean, this was very pronounced in the United States recently with President Trump's so-called Muslim ban. And, you know, Indigenous activists like the Tohono O'odham First Nation or Tohono O'odham Nation saying no ban on stolen land, right? Going right to this point about who has the authority to govern settlement, sanctuary, refuge, all of these questions. So for me, sanctuary, again, you know, some people might look at this and think this is such a marginal topic, but to me, it goes so much to the core of how people understand community and responsibility and their sense of place, and all the power dynamics that flow from individual acts of sanctuary. To me, there's so much richness in understanding all of these different parts, because I think they let us understand a great deal about our history, but also our present and maybe our future.
Yeah, that's amazing. I really enjoyed how you characterize some of these movements as contesting, you know, state actions and decisions, and also just recognizing the plurality of the legal systems in our country and the plurality of the sources of authority and legal understanding of how we're governed. So it raises so many questions that you think sanctuary is just about giving safe haven to someone in a church, but there's so much more to it. So I think we could speak about this for hours, honestly. I have so many other questions, but I'm cognizant of the length of a podcast episode, and maybe we'll have you come back for, you know, a future, you know, episode where we can flesh out more of these ideas. But I'm really grateful for your time and sharing the amazing work that you do, and for also just highlighting some of the, you know, amazing threads through time as to what kind of space that we're living in now, and what does it tell us, how the past can really inform us as to what the moment is really about, what we're sitting in right now. So thank you, Laura.
Well, thank you. It was such a pleasure to chat with you about issues that I know you care about very much as well. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever had anyone read my book so closely and ask such careful questions. And so it was a real pleasure. And I do look forward to not necessarily coming back, although I would love to, but I do think this podcast is so wonderful. So I look forward to future episodes.
Thank you, Laura. Migration Conversations is created and hosted by me, Professor Jamie Liu, and produced by University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow June Gleed. This podcast was made possible with the guidance and assistance of University of Ottawa Tech Law Fellow Ritesh Kotak, Carleton University graduate student Rachel McNally, as well as the generous support of Carleton University and the University of Ottawa Shared Online Projects Initiatives. You can find more Migration Conversations episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube with closed captions. Thank you for listening, and a special thank you for all the guests who have shared their experiences publicly.